and welcome to Inside Education on 103.2 Dublin City FM, the programme that brings you insights into teaching, learning and all aspects of education from an Irish perspective. My name is Sean Delaney and you can listen to or download podcasts of previous editions of Inside Education on insideed.com. A conference on leadership in education was held recently in Malahide and it was attended by educational leaders from all over Europe and further afield. It was organised by Enerdelm and it was just the second time for the annual conference to be held in Ireland. One of the speakers at the event was Professor John West Burnham from St Mary's University in Twickenham in England. Professor West Burnham has held posts in several universities and he also worked in schools and in further education for 15 years before moving into higher education. He has worked in many countries as an advisor to governments and as an independent consultant. His talk was about leading future-focused education and learning for all. When I met up with Professor John West Burnham, I first asked him to tell me what the key message was for those attending his talk.
The key message of my presentation was essentially to draw attention to the need to move away from a preoccupation with current demands and imperatives and adopting a more strategic view in terms of a longer time frame, a broader perspective. And schools are very busy places, as you know. Schools are very challenging on a day-to-day routine basis. And therefore, school leaders sometimes can get very bogged down in not the trivia, but in very much the routines. And so what I was hoping to do, which is not unique to myself, is simply to provide an opportunity to step back and say we need from time to time to spend a while rethinking the basis on which we're working, questioning the assumptions, and crucially beginning to take into account the changing context.
So it's really about trying to differentiate between the urgent and the important.
Absolutely. That's one of a number of ways of expressing it. But essentially, schools essentially are urgent places. And they do a lot of stuff which is important, but actually there's a different level of importance, I would argue, which is to move into the core values of the business, to explore where we want to be, almost a utopian view as to how education should be, which sometimes can get lost in the norms that we work to on a daily basis.
So how do school leaders go about creating the space to focus on these things? Because, as you said, they're very busy and there's all kinds of demands coming at them from the time they walk into the building.
I think it's the same for all human beings, isn't it? We have to actually say we're going to sit down together at home and have a meal together. We're going to spend some time on holiday together and so on. And I think it's an act of will, essentially. And I'm not in any way diminishing the challenges for, say, the principal of a small rural primary school who is working 12 hours a day as it is. But I do think we need to embed the notion that thinking strategically is a part of the leadership role, and therefore it is as important as any other dimension, and therefore needs to be given time. For example, in larger schools, well, even in small schools, there could be in staff meetings or training and development sessions, perhaps just an hour a month given to, can we just talk about the future? What's going on? And then also to start networking, because that's when I think when school leaders come together, that's when they can talk about the way things ought to be rather than the way things are.
So from what you're saying, it sounds to me that this is something that the school leader does with others rather than something they do on their own.
Oh, absolutely. I think they need to think on their own. You know, they need to do perhaps the reading. They need to be aware intellectually of what all the issues are. But nevertheless, it's something that they need to do with their senior colleagues. In most school systems around the world, they need to be doing it with the community as well, governors, trustees, or whatever. But it's a process which is a collaborative process and pivotally needs to involve staff, needs to involve children as well, because they have a right to be part of the talk about the future, and also their parents. But I think that it's initiated by leaders who recognise that there's got to be a time devoted to moving beyond the day-to-day.
And how can a principal get buy-in from teachers in a school who maybe don't see their role as being leadership roles, but they're just busy with the day-to-day teaching they have to do?
And that, I think, is one of the key challenges. And it really is something that will change according to the culture of the school. I think effective school leaders and very experienced principals almost create a set of expectations that teachers, it's not enough just to teach your subject, say. It's actually part of your role as a professional educator is to be involved in wider and broader issues because they will have a direct impact upon your classroom practice. And therefore, you can't actually hide in your classroom and put the cloak of your subject around you or the age range that you teach in the primary school. You have to be a more extended professional.
And this particular conference has a theme called Leadership for Future-Focused Education and Learning. Given that the future is, to some extent at least, unknown, could future-focused education lead inadvertently in a wrong direction?
Of course, yes. And I think that, of course, the future is unknown and it is unknowable. But actually, I do believe, and I think this goes back to personal lives, that we make choices, we make decisions. And I think everybody who thinks about this says, at some time in my life, I chose to go to A or go to B. Even down to when we were students, we chose to go to party A rather than party B, and that changed our lives. And therefore, we can make choices which have long-term implications. And therefore, the work of the leader, I think, is to work through those implications and to begin to explore essentially scenarios, hypothetical ways of thinking about the future, which may or may not come true. For example, if you think back over the past 5 years, the impact of information technology has just been remarkable. Nobody could have anticipated in 2010 where we are in terms of the social networking and so on. But on the basis of the past 5 years, it's reasonable to extrapolate that that trend will continue. And so information technology will become even more available, even cheaper, and far more invasive in terms of how we live our lives. That's a reasonable prediction to work on, and therefore we can begin to anticipate the future, if not actually predict it.
So what kind of resources are there to support a principal who wants to think in a future-focused direction?
Clearly, the future-thinking principal needs to have the psychological disposition that they're comfortable with the idea of change. Change is a very complex, very emotional process. So people who are comfortable with change are more likely to want to engage. And then I think there's a huge literature, there are lots of networks like this conference which are absolutely committed to the notion of building up supportive infrastructures, relationships, which allow and encourage this conversation to take place. And the more I'm involved with this work, the more I see my role as essentially is facilitating conversations, you know, and really getting people to begin to speculate. You know, and it's something that we do very naturally. If you've ever travelled any distance with a child in a car, you know, there will be part of the conversation will be, what do I want to do when I grow up? Well, in some ways, the principal has to have that conversation. What do we want to be when we grow up? And that, I think, is something that is natural, but has to be given time and has to be nurtured. And crucially, has to draw on, as I said, the enormous range of information that's now available, hypothetically, but also practically.
And if you were to make a good guess at what schools would be like in, say, a decade's time, what would you put your money on?
Well, I think it's how we would actually say what are our priorities in thinking about the school that we want in the future. My own personal view is that one of the key driving forces, certainly in Ireland, certainly in the UK and across much of Europe, is this whole issue of securing effective education for every student. At the moment, schools in Ireland, the UK, etc., do very well by some students, but not by all students. There's a real issue of equity. So my own view would be that in 10 years' time, we've made significant progress to securing the inclusion of every child in quality teaching and learning. Now, that means, I think, for example, that we've got to start personalising approaches so we're far more sensitive to the needs of the individual child, that we start with the child rather than with the system and so on. I think information technology is going to have a huge role to play in that, in terms of enabling the school to be far more discriminatory in the way it provides alternative provision, so that it discriminates between different needs, different times, discrimination in a positive sense there. It's a bit like people going to the supermarket. You know, that one of the joys of the supermarket is that you have choices. My local supermarket, I counted up one day, when I was standing in the queue, has 35 different types of olive oil available. That's nonsense. Nobody needs 35 different types, but we want the choice. And I think that increasing choice in education in terms of what I learn, where I learn it, who I learn it with, and so on, I think probably is going to be crucial in terms of education in a democratic society, but also in terms of saying every child is receiving the education that they are entitled to, especially those with special needs, but also for the most able and those who are just in the middle who deserve equal attention.
And if we take that idea, couldn't that mean that some students will shy away from challenging subjects or maybe what they would consider to be boring subjects in favour of strengths and may not have such a broad curriculum as they would have had in the, say, 20 years ago?
I think that's very fair, and I think we need to explore what it means. But essentially, I almost certainly will have to go shopping tomorrow morning in the supermarket, and part of the shopping will be the basics that every household needs. And we need the bread, we need the milk, we need the meat, we need the vegetables, the fruit, and so on. So I think I've got no problem with the notion that a personalised curriculum has certain elements which are non-negotiable in terms of well-being and health. And therefore, the curriculum is a balancing act between that which we believe to be essential, and clearly numeracy and literacy are the fundamentals, but then to create wider opportunities. A personal example, if I may, my son works in motor racing, and at school, that's all he wanted to do. And so when it came to his subject choices at the age of 14, he wanted to do physics because he wanted to be an engineer, and he wanted to study Italian because he wanted to be a certain type of engineer working in fast cars, i.e. working for Ferrari. And the school said that he had to do German, because the subject banding in that school meant that you couldn't do physics and Italian, you had to do physics and German. So it's just as if we go into a shop and they say, if you buy this, you must buy that. And you say, no, I make my choice. I think we've got to give pupils the core in terms of what they have to do, but then really open up the possibilities in different ways. And my son now works in a racing team that has Ferrari engines, so he's nearly there. But the notion is that we need to be far more sensitive to the student, because what we know about the engagement of school students is that it's the intrinsic motivation that really takes them forward. What do they want to do? What do they believe in?
And if we continue with that example, the provision of Italian is very much dependent on the resources available in a school. So are you thinking of bigger schools? Are you thinking of a different distribution of resources? How what's this going to mean in practice?
I mean, this is purely hypothetical, but basically if my son were in the situation now, then there would be two things that I would say to the school. Firstly, there are some magical language programs available with information technology. You know, some of the stuff is really world class. But within the community, for example, there was an Italian restaurant, there was an Italian hairdresser, and so maybe my son would be given time to work through the information technology. He would couple up with a couple of his friends who also wanted to study Italian, and he would spend an hour a week with the local hairdresser who would teach them colloquial Italian. Then we get a really effective engagement, but we also get the fact that education is not confined to the school for 6 hours a day, but across the whole community.
Do you think that would undermine the work of teachers?
I think we have to be very clear that teachers have a highly significant role. For example, teachers would support my son in managing the process and so on. But actually, it would be far wider than that, because education is much broader than the school. For example, most European students spend about 16% of the year in school. They spend about 40% of the year asleep, and that means that they're spending a substantial amount of time, 45% of the year, awake, busy, learning, but outside the school system. In education, we do not have a monopoly on learning. Learning takes place everywhere all the time, and teachers can be enormously skillful in helping to manage that relationship between the broader context, the community, and the school.
So does it take a teacher then, or could that just be a manager, somebody who's good at systems, for example, rather than who has a deep knowledge of education and of learning and so on?
I think it has to be a teacher, because you need that basic deep understanding and commitment to what education's about. And therefore, you can't just make it into some kind of managerial activity. It has to be a much more robust and deeper understanding of how children click. You know, just timetabling a school is a technical task, but actually deploying teachers to best effect is a very sophisticated educational process.
Your work, John, you have a wide range of interests in education. You know, you've written on topics as diverse as bullying, deep learning, leadership, and spiritual and moral development in schools. What do you see that unifies your various interests in education?
I suppose, first and foremost, it's learning. It's talking about learning. I find it amazing that we still need to have conversations about what learning is and how we talk about it and how we understand it and so on. Learning is an immensely complex process, but it's at the very heart of what we do in education. And virtually all of my work focuses really on how do we secure the sort of educational activity which allows learning to take place. And therefore, it doesn't matter whether it's the tiniest child just beginning to build confidence in language, or whether it's extraordinarily sophisticated pre-university students who are really beginning to grasp complex conceptual ideas and so on. The notion is they're all learning, and that, I think, is at the heart of my work.
And what do you think is it that promotes learning in schools?
First and foremost, it's back to this notion of intrinsic motivation. You know, that if I really want to engage, and we've all met people who've got this, like my son's obsession with motor cars, but also with almost every dimension, you know, whether it's the dancer, the musician, the sports person, and so on. And that, I think, is fundamental. And then we need some fairly hard science in terms of understanding the learning processes that go on. You know, learning is a neurological process, and we're only at the very edges of understanding how it works. But we do know, for example, that it's a social relationship. The best learning takes place through social interaction, having the conversation that you and I are having at the moment, and then engaging in the review of that conversation, the application of that conversation, and pivotally this notion of the feedback on practice and so on. That's when learning really does seem to make a difference.
You've written about the learning-centred school. What do you mean by that term?
It sounds almost nonsense, you know, in the sense that, of course, every school is concerned with learning. The notion of the learning-centred school is essentially one whereby we recognise human difference. We recognise different patterns of working. We recognise different needs. For example, there's some very strong evidence that points to the fact that young teenagers are going through a huge process of neurological change. Their brains are really sorting themselves out. And one piece of evidence says actually when they're asleep, that's when the process takes place. So they need lots of sleep. So one school in London has actually starting the school day at 10 o'clock in order that students don't have to be up at 6:30 to get there and so on, because they need the sleep. Now, that's a very simple example, but what it's saying basically is we design the school to be fit for purpose around learning. And so most of us will remember our school days as being one subject, second subject, third subject, fourth subject. Well, that's okay, but it does seem to be the case, for example, that the world doesn't actually work through subjects. The learning-centred school often has students working on individual projects, crucially collaborative projects. And that's where, for example, there's real preparation for adult life, because the vast majority of people go to work collaboratively on solving projects. It doesn't matter whether you're working in a hotel kitchen, on a building site, in an operating theatre. Human beings working collaboratively to solve problems, that's how people work. So that would be, for me, one of the key characteristics of the learning-centred school. It would not be bound by 8:30 to 4 o'clock. It would not be bound by so many weeks a year. It would be a place where people, the patterns of learning are so different, and we need to recognise that. And we also need to recognise, going back to a previous point, that you don't have to be a teacher to help somebody learn. And we need a community. For example, one of the best components of a learning-centred school would be involving parents, particularly the youngest children, as co-educators of their children. Because as we just discussed, the children spend a limited amount of time in school, a huge amount of time at home, and that we know that in what we might describe as literate households, there's an enormous impact in terms of a child's academic potential. So the learning school enables that sort of process to take place across the wider community.
You've said that that knowledge doesn't exist in the world in subject divisions, yeah, like the way we divide them up in school. And yet, one of the reasons that subjects are used is to organise the work of the school. How would you actually organise the work of the school around learning?
Well, that's the complex one, isn't it? Where it does work is, for example, there are Swedish schools where students go into school on a Monday morning and negotiate with their tutors their work for the week, which they then present on Friday afternoon. And so you're having a personalised pathway through the week. And you've got to spend a certain amount of time each week on your maths, a certain amount of time each week on your Swedish or whatever, but then you're working collaboratively for some of the time, on your own for some of the time, you're working using IT for some of the time, you are being coached by somebody who's supporting you in your learning, and it's a very complex process, but no more complex than arranging train timetables or holiday bookings and so on. You know, we've got the technology to handle it, but the idea is to create lots and lots and lots of pathways where there are opportunities for different types of learning to take place. I mean, the very early years, the infant and nursery level schools, they are brilliant at this. You know, you cannot actually control a four-year-old. You know, they know what they need to do to learn. And early years teachers are extraordinarily skillful in actually engaging with the child to point them in certain directions, to get them to play collaboratively and cooperatively. It's the same with special education. Teachers and others, adults in special education, really have a wonderful way of organising learning so that the child is making progress irrespective of what's going on around them. And I think those two, for me, provide a model as to how the school might look in the future.
But isn't a key thing with those two examples that you've chosen, early childhood education and special education, teachers don't have, in those settings, don't have the same pressure maybe of something you mentioned earlier, of assessment and of kind of, you know, being pushed from other educational parties, say for results on standardised tests and so on in these areas. And isn't there this conflict between the learning-centred school on the one hand and the pressures on teachers to be accountable, I suppose, to standardised tests?
Oh, absolutely right. And I wouldn't deduct that issue at all, because one of the things we have to change as well is how we assess, because the rather brutal forms of assessment that are found in most European countries, North America and so on, bear very little relationship to what I've been talking about in terms of learning. And indeed, they are often quite seriously flawed in terms of their accuracy and so on. I mean, the problems we've had in the UK with our exams at 16, whereby the statistical basis of assessment throws up all sorts of distortions. So let's not pretend that assessment is actually working well. I think we've got to move towards an assessment which is much more based on a range of negotiated outcomes. We have to trust teachers more. We have to have very robust criteria. But we need to recognise that performance in an academic subject is not enough in terms of an educated human being. And that's why, for example, the International Baccalaureate programme, I think, is so powerful, because it has academic rigour, but it also has community service in it. And that, I think, is a very powerful combination. It also has a study on the how we learn. And therefore, it's providing those cornerstones for effective learning, all of which are assessed, but the notion is it's more than simply the ability to replicate academic information.
Another area you've written about is the whole area of trust in leadership. Why is trust important?
It's important because it's the basis of every human relationship. In education, if I'm really going to learn, if I'm really going to make progress, then I've got to trust my teachers. If teachers are going to be working effectively, they've got to trust their principal. And it really is embedded right the way through the system. The research that's been done, which isn't very much, points to the fact that, by and large, schools which are high in trust are also high-performing schools. So it may be that what we need to do is to spend more time building trust rather than beating the academic drum, you know, more teaching, and say, no, let's just work on how we trust each other, and then that, I'm certain, would lead to higher performance, greater engagement, and so on. If you're working with people you trust, you tend to work better.
And how do you create trust, or how do you build this trusting relationship between leaders of schools and teachers in a school?
Michael Fullan has a wonderful line in his work on change, and he says, very simply, trust comes after good experiences, which I think is a great, you know, just a magnificently clear, crisp quote, which gives us the sense. We trust each other because over time we are positively reinforcing each other. And that's the basis, that you make sure that the experiences are positive and good. It's the same way that children will trust their parents because there are a sequence of good experiences. The minute that there's a bad experience, the trust is compromised. And that's the issue. School leaders, teachers in classrooms, build on positive relationships, and that builds the trust. That's where the confidence comes in.
Finally, John, when people are driving home from the conference today and they're thinking back on what they heard and what they learned, what would you like them to be saying that John West Burnham spoke about?
I hope they'll feel that I confirmed and affirmed that they do wonderful things. You know, that I think that we need to be more and more open about the fact that the vast majority of children live wonderful lives and go to great schools and really are cherished and nurtured. And the privilege I've had of working in Irish schools over the past 15 years is one of the astonishing quality of what goes on. I hope that's the positive they take away. The challenge that I hope they take away is, how do we secure that for everybody? And that, for me, is the real issue, because in Ireland, in the UK, in France and Germany, Italy, Spain, most children go to school, but not every child goes to a good school. And that's the challenge.
And that is a challenge we'll be returning to again and again on this programme in the future. That was John West Burnham, independent consultant and professor of educational leadership at St Mary's University, Twickenham in England, bringing this week's Inside Education to a close. John West Burnham gave a keynote address at last month's Enerdelm conference, which was held in Malahide in Dublin. You can listen to or download podcasts of previous Inside Education programmes on insideed.com. You can get in touch with the programme by writing to me with feedback or suggestions to insideeducation@dublincityfm.ie. Until the same time next week, this is Sean Delaney signing off. Thank you for listening.